Hello, everyone, and welcome to join us today. Today's seminar is part of AOMSTR Division's Impact and Relevance virtual seminar series. We will focus on publishing with non-US data in strategy and management journals. I am Cecilia from Georgia State University. Fabrice from the University of Hong Kong will co-host today's seminar with me. And before we start, here are two and three housekeeping items. The first, this will be a roughly a 1.5-hour seminar. The session will be recorded and will be posted on AOMSTR YouTube channel once ready. As you know, this is a Zoom meeting format, so please kindly mute yourself and feel free to post your questions and comments in the chat box. Fabrice and I will monitor the chat box and try our best to get to these questions during the session. Now, without further ado, I'll pass it to Louis. Louis, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Cecilia. My name is Louise Morse. I am the Division Chair of STR, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event on publishing with non-US data in strategy and management journals. And as Cecilia mentioned, this is part of a series. This is the second seminar in a series we're going to be running this year on the impact and relevance of strategic management. So please keep an eye on the STR homepage for advertisements of the next events. We have further events in January. And I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting conversation today. I want to thank the panelists very much for being here and participating, and of course also to Cecilia and Fabrice for organizing this session. So let me hand over to Fabrice. He's going to introduce the event further and also the speakers of today.
Well, thank you very much, Louise, and welcome everyone to our session on with non-US data in strategy management journals. So my name is, I'm from the University of Hong Kong. I'm a professor in strategic management. I'm also on the executive committee of the STR division, and I'm delighted to introduce this session with, I'm co-organizing with Cecilia Gu from Georgia State. So today we'll discuss the various aspects of using data collected from countries other than the United States in management research, including the challenges, the advantages, and also future directions for this type of research. So before presenting our speakers, let me briefly introduce the topic. So as a researcher working with non-US data, you might have come across comments questioning the generalizability and relevance of your findings due to the reliance on data from specific countries. So on this slide, I reported some personal examples I received from editors and reviewers, such as the reliance on French data in this study raises concerns about the generalizability of the findings, or it's important for the authors to spell out what the Chinese context does and does not have in common with the rest of the world regarding these relationships. Or again, from the well-known reviewer Chu questions the degree to which insights captured in this way from a survey conducted in Germany might generalize to other parts of the world. So these comments often highlight the need to clarify the similarities and differences between the studied context and the rest of the world. And some of the challenges of working with non-US data include limited generalizability, issues with data accessibility and quality, publication biases from certain journals and reviewers, as well as cultural, contextual, language, and translation issues. These challenges can pose significant barriers to researchers trying to publish their work. So I'm curious to know whether and also to what extent our panelists have met such challenges. And despite these challenges, incorporating non-US data may offer several advantages, such as providing diverse perspectives, unique insights, and also opportunities to address global issues. It also allows us to conduct comparative analysis and the exploration of under-researched topics or emerging trends, thereby enriching our understanding of management and strategy across different contexts. And to address these questions and many others, we have invited three well-published scholars who have worked with non-US data. So today I'm delighted to introduce first Percy Huggins from Erasmus University. As you may know, Percy's research relates to comparative corporate governance, business ethics, and bureaucracy. We also have Elena Kulchina from North Carolina State University. Elena has done some very interesting work on foreign and domestic entrepreneurs, as well as the management of multinational ventures. And finally, my colleague Kevin Chow from the University of Hong Kong. Kevin has published extensively on capability and innovation and trust and relational ties in emerging economies. So thank you very much, Percy, Elena, and Kevin, for being with us today. So now I'm going to turn to Cecilia.
Thank you, Fabrice, for the nice introduction. Before we start, another reminder for the participants. Please make sure to mute yourself unless you have any questions or comments later on throughout the discussion session. Now, let's move on with our discussion. So as Fabrice mentioned, our panelists today are no strangers to top journal publications with non-US data. So the first question we are going to discuss today is about the past. So I will have to ask the three panelists today, what are your past experiences publishing with non-US data? Given the time constraints, please just share one major benefits and maybe one main challenges you have had in the process. We will go with the order to Elena first, Kevin, and then next with Percy. 5 minutes roughly for each of you. So now, Elena, the floor is yours, Elena.
Let me share my slide. Yes, if you don't mind sharing my slides.
Absolutely.
And while Cecilia is doing that, thank you so much for inviting me. It's my pleasure being here and sharing my experience, which is in fact very similar to what Fabrice just said. And Cecilia, if you can go, yeah, awesome, in the presenter mode. So just a few questions about what kind of data I was using and am using in my studies. My settings are very broad. I started from looking at firms in Russia, which at that time wasn't a common setting at all. And now I'm also working on the data from Denmark, Portugal, Spain, South Korea, and the United States. So just a few words about some benefits and challenges on using this data. When you work with non-US data, you usually come across some interesting and unexplored variables and settings that are not common in other studies. So this is definitely the benefit of the data outside of the United States. And you can take advantage of those variables and interesting questions. Often other countries provide you with convenient natural experiments and instruments that you can use to address endogeneity concerns in empirical studies. And again, maybe not so much a benefit for more junior scholars, but I was always fascinated to see that previous theories and previous empirical findings actually replicate in other empirical settings outside of the United States. That gave me the feeling, the sense of validity of what we are doing, and that what we are finding in our studies is actually true, but not some statistical fluke. In terms of the challenges, of course, the benefits never come without challenges and concerns. The key one was definitely generalizability that Fabrice has already mentioned. I don't think I had a single paper that they published or which is in the review process now where I didn't have at least one reviewer saying, oh, but how are these results generalizable outside of your setting? The second concern could be that measures in other countries do not necessarily apply one-to-one. Even common measures like performance measures and balance sheet measures do not necessarily apply one-to-one in different countries. So you have to be very careful with that. And finally, if you're not a native, especially if you're not a native speaker of the country that you study, some things can be lost in translation. So Google Translate doesn't always do a good job working on the data. And if you're not a native of the countries that you study, unfortunately, again, it's not necessarily my experience, but that's what I've heard. some reviewers who are the natives of the study can be quite possessive of the setting and can attack non-native researchers who study their setting a bit too harsh. So that could be a concern as well. And I think we'll talk more about how you address these challenges later on.
Yeah, perfect.
We can move on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Elena. Generalizability seems to be a major issue that all of us will face when using non-US data. We will get back to these questions in the discussion and later on in other questions as well. In the meantime, let me pass on to Kevin.
Yeah, can you also share my slides?
Yes, I am pulling them up.
It's my pleasure to share my 5 cents of the experience. I joined Hong Kong U for 20 years. Okay, actually, I benefit a lot from this non-US data. Actually, all of my data are from China. And I would say my approach in the first decade, not 2 decades, in the first decade, the approach is conceptualize the unique features. Because at that time, everybody talked about China, why China grows so rapidly, despite all the criticisms and all the doubts. So the important thing is to add the insights from non-US data by introducing the unique features. Typically, China's most unique features are about institutional forces regarding its government, its party leadership, its legal environment, as well as the social cultural things. The most famous one is Guanxi ties, Confucius value, leadership, and also the economic conditions. So despite China's lack of capital at that time and skilled labor, it grows rapidly. So actually this puzzle provides a lot of insights to the traditional Western theory. Okay. And to give us an example, Guanxi, for example, Guanxi actually aroused a lot of research interest at that time. Okay. More than 100 papers published in top tier business journals, including strategy, management, marketing, OM, and finance, accounting. So at that time, what we want to do is to identify the uniqueness of Guanxi and conceptualize it with a unique concept. So for me, this approach is about China question, it's a China phenomenon and a China construct, China concept. Okay, so that's a benefit because it's very new. Westerners feel curious about what is Guanxi because we always heard about who you know is more important than what you know in China. So what is really Guanxi? So at that time, that's actually the advantage for us to get published. But of course, over time, when we talk too much about Guanxi, then scholars raise questions. The challenge is Guanxi really different? Is it really different from the personal ties in the Western concept? For example, in China, we talk about Guanxi, but in the US, we talk about boys and the girls club. We also have personal relationship. We also use personal relationship to get business done. So that's a major challenge, is the concept of Guanxi particular to China, or it is a universal concept. So that's the reason, because of these challenges, the first approach, conceptualizing unique features, is not as popular as before. Today, it's quite difficult to take this approach to get published at top tier journal. Now, how to address this challenge? Let's wait for the next slide. Okay.
Oh, thank you, Kevin, for the nice transition. Indeed, I may have missed this in the introduction, but today's discussion will be structured based on 3 questions. the past, the present, and the future. So if you just join us, we are now talking about the past, and we have asked our panelists to discuss their experience in the past in terms of successfully publishing their paper with non-US data. They will also share some of the challenges that they had during this journey. So moving next to Percy. Let me stop sharing Percy's. And then, okay, this is Percy, floor is yours.
Yeah, and there we go. Hey, first of all, thanks, Fabrice, and thanks also to you, Cecilia, for throwing this together. I'm super excited. Hey, I've taken the same question that we already reflected on, but I thought I'd approach it from a slightly more theoretical angle. And two terms that I'm going to throw at you are the terms cosmopolitan and the terms endemic, and they actually come from population ecology, from biology even. And there they are taken to mean, are we reflecting on a species that does exist globally, and then we'll call it a cosmopolitan species, or are we talking about a species that only exists in a specific locale, and then we call it an endemic species? So extrapolating this to management, I think that for a very long time, we've all been super excited about working with what you could call these cosmopolitan theories of management, right? And they're listed here. Institutional theory, resource dependence theory, transaction cost theory, et cetera, et cetera. So theories that are believed to have something of a universal value to them. Well, some of you that know my work, and certainly bless you if you don't, but I've meta-analyzed things for a living for a long time. So I've analyzed, meta-analyzed many of these theories, and in all honesty, the results tend to be fairly sobering, right? I mean, if you actually look at the explanatory power of these theories, even on their main predictions, the mean that these have, so the meta-analytic mean that these theories tend to yield is oftentimes scarily close to zero. And more importantly, what you also see is that the effect size distribution is oftentimes, the spread therein is oftentimes very substantial, meaning that for any of these major theories, there are an awful lot of observations that are to the very far right of the mean, and a lot of them that are to the very far left of the mean. So, and if you just want to pin some basic figures on this, if you look at the actual theory proper names, on the left-hand side, you see the main average effect size in the US. On the right-hand side, just to give you a comparison, the main
Oh,
average
that's
effect
cool.
size in China. And so that's already already quite different. So the thing that I take away from this is that many of these theories that we work with, that we think are universal, and that are oftentimes our reference points in questions of generalizability, in fact, are at best contingency theories themselves. And so the question that I would like to put up today is then, can we say something systematic about these contingencies? And let me get there in a second. If we move to the right-hand panel, that's the last thing that I'll say right now. I think it is important to realize that even all of these theories, which we think are universal, also very much bear the imprint of the time and the place in which they emerged, right? I mean, what is unique about these theories is that pretty much all of them emerged between the 1970s and the 1990s in the US. And then, as Bert Schoonhoven and Dobbin would like to remind us, a lot of them actually got their start at Stanford. But think about how the world looked at that time, right? And the thing that I'm going to stress today is that even these theories bear the imprint of a very unique locale, right? The world was unipolar. The US was the global behemoth. It was a period in which also neoliberalism was strongly on the rise, had the Reagan and Thatcherite era. We all collectively celebrated free competition. We liked it that our governments receded. A lot of formerly state-owned enterprises were privatized. Ever since the Eisenhower administration, we saw the rise of very strong pro-business lobbying, which created a very fruitful landscape for many businesses. And the society in which all these theories emerged, and contrast that with what Kevin just said about the Chinese context and the importance of Guangxi there. The society there was formalized, legalistic, and extremely litigious. So, what I just wanted to impose to you as my opening barrage is that these theories that we oftentimes think of as cosmopolitan theories were built very specifically for this world, and for this specific time period in the US world. So if you actually look at the left-hand panel again and you look at the numbers for China, you see that they are, except for the resource-based theory, quite a bit lower than those for the US, right? I mean, so many of these theories just have a much poorer fit with China than they did have with the US at the time. So even the world that they were built for actually no longer exists, right? I mean, if you think about the US right now and you think about the above properties, it's pretty clear that the US, for example, if you look at the fact that it's now a much more isolationist country than, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, the world there has changed as well. So where I'm going to stop right now, and it's hopefully exactly at the 5-minute mark, is that what we therefore need is a lot more attention to endemic theorizing, and we'll turn there next. Over to you, Cecilia.
Thank you, Percy. So before I let you go, there is a question from Michael to you regarding your comments on can we identify systematic differences in the findings across geographic context? How does the variance, Michael's question is, how does the variance in the empirical context help us identify boundary conditions and refine theoretical claims? Do you want to address this question for the
next? It's not intended
part?
As a question. I'm promoting. I agree with what he's saying, right? So I'm hearing something positive. We should be using the data and the context to retest and refine our theory. So, thumbs up. Thank you, Percy.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michael. And I guess the format is that we said there'll be time for open discussion at the end of the session, Cecilia. Why don't we just stick with that format and then we'll return to the issue.
Sure, sounds good. So with that, thank you all three of you to sharing your experience in the past based on your successful journey publishing data, non-US data in top journals. Now, let me move on to the next question about the present. So the question for you is, what are the state of art approaches to address the challenges of publishing with non-US data in top journals? I see some questions popping out related to solutions to these challenges as well. And you, all three of you, have kind of leaning towards some of the challenges just now in your sharing of the past. So first I will pass on to Kevin.
Okay. Okay, can you share my slides?
Yes. Let me see.
The next one?
There you go.
Okay, so the challenge we are facing now is we talk too much about the uniqueness about China. Then I reveal all these questions that, so what is really unique? Is Guanxi that unique or is Guanxi universal? So if we take the first approach, conceptualize Guanxi, then we say Guanxi is unique. But this has been receiving increasing criticism. So that's the reason in recent 5 years, we see more approach, which I say is a second approach by micronized unique features. So what is micronized unique features? It means we talk about the unique phenomena in China, but we measure it with a secondary data, secondary indicator. By measuring it with secondary data indicator, the implication is a universal concept, but with China unique China questions. For example, political ideology, this is a universal concept. It exists everywhere. In the US, we have blue and red. In China, we have communist political ideology. Okay. And in Europe, we have left and right. So political ideology is a universal concept. But the unique question we have in China is, in this paper, for example, we ask why, after 40 years of economic reform, the Maoist communist ideology is still prevalent in China. So that's the unique question. Suppose after 40 years of economic reform, then we will see, so everybody is embracing the market economy, right? But how come the Maoist ideology is still so important in China, as we can see from today's China's practice? So with this question in mind, we measure political ideology with party membership. So the main effect shows the persistence of Maoist ideology. But the good thing is the Maoist ideology decreased with the younger chair and with the chair's education. The key here is when we have many old guys around, this will cause the decay of the decreasing effect, which means those old guys, old party members, will reinforce the traditional old Maoist ideology. So this is an example I used to illustrate the second approach. Identify a puzzle in China or in Latin America, in Brazil, identify a puzzle. But the key here is we use the universal concept and you use universal theory. Here the theory is imprinting theory. But the question is China unique? The puzzle is China unique? So in this way, we can address the challenge of the universal concept challenge. Okay. So I see more and more paper are taking this approach to address the unique puzzle in non-US context. Okay, that's my sharing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kevin. We'll get back to you in a second. And next we will have Percy to take on this question about the present. I'm pulling up your slide.
Yeah, thank you, Cecilia. And so what I'm going to say is to a large extent, very continuous with what Kevin and what Elena have been saying all along. Next slide, please, Cecilia. Yeah, thank you so much. And the way that I would just like to zoom out a little bit from what Kevin has been saying is that if you start with the right-hand panel and you look at the little red and blue figure here, and I think that many of the ways in which we tend to theorize is by simply looking at firms as they naturally occur, and then there's a double arrow, so irrespective of whether you consider yourself a deductivist, an inductivist, or an abductivist, we tend to base our theories on the firms that we see in context, and then we oftentimes assume that this is the way towards building the broadest, most generalizable body of knowledge. What I would like to bring here, of course, is kind of like the endemic perspective, and that is that if you do that, you kind of neglect the fact that firms at all times and in all places of the world are very much conditioned by the institutional conditions in which they operate and by the historical events that they live through. And the more you acknowledge that, and the more you also deliberately build that into your theory, the more you are building endemic theories of strategic management, right? And whether you do that from macro events or from the micro peculiarities that Kevin pointed to, in both cases, you are busy endemic theorizing. Now, let's switch to the left-hand panel and let's think a little bit about what we are saying here, right? So endemic comes from the Greek, and means in, demos means people. So essentially we are studying people or organizations in their context. And so endemic theories of strategic management do explain the behavior and outcomes of organizations residing in a particular ecological niche and account for the institutional and historical factors shaping the niche itself. And the two make up for endemic theorizing. Now, what I would say is that if you embrace endemism, if you believe that endemic theories exist, of course, you are not denying the potential and perhaps even the attractiveness of cosmopolitan theories, right? That's not the point. But, and now things get a little spicier, if we are on the lookout for more endemic theories, we of course are not necessarily looking at rare events, right? I mean, oftentimes we, you can go up once more, Cecilia, because this is the punchline for the third part. But if you, can you go up one slide? Yeah, thanks so much. So endemic doesn't mean rare, right? I mean, I think that in a way it is peculiar, of course, that and we've heard a lot of people saying this right now, that we constantly have to defend ourselves when we are using non-US data. If you think about the fact, for example, that roughly 5.5 times as many people are formally employed by Chinese organizations in China than by US organizations in the US, right? I mean, 95% of the world population does not live in the US. So endemic theories are everywhere. an endemic phenomenon and an endemic population does not mean that it is rare. So what breeds the potential for endemism? Well, one thing that we know from biology is that stability helps, right? And so if you think about China, which has had the influence of a dedicated corps of professional bureaucrats for at least 3,000 years, it is clear that new organizational forms that operate according to their own logic are built and spawned under those conditions. Stability, if you find stable regimes, that definitely produces high rates of endemism. Another interesting fact from biology is that the smaller the organism, and so perhaps also the smaller the organization, the higher the chance of cosmopolitanism. So if you want to look at organizations that look the same all across the world, if you're really interested in building theories that work everywhere, you may have to build theories for smaller organizations, but not for larger ones. So what you could call concession stand economics, the average concession stand in New York looks a lot like the average concession stand in Beijing. For those organizations, you can build cosmopolitan theories. But for example, technology giants are different everywhere, and they are governed by different laws, and therefore also need more endemic theorizing. Final thing that I would say is that another thing that we see, of course, is that neo-endemism, as it is known, is also rampant, right? I mean, policy interventions, like, for example, the CHIPS and Science Act of 2022 in the US, inevitably breed new endemic forms that you're not going to find anywhere else in the world, but that do require their own theorizing. So I'll stop here for now, Cecilia, and keep in mind that my plea is that we need more aspects of endemism when it comes to theorizing strategic management. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Percy. Very, very insightful perspective on the present. Mm-hmm. Let me stop sharing your slides here and then pass on to Elena. I'm pulling out your slides. Oh, this is...
I don't see that somewhere.
Let me try again.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, great. Can you go? Yes, the second slide. Thank you. I was talking about the approaches to address the challenges. Can you go maybe a slide up? See the current approach. No, there was another slide. Okay, never mind. Let's go to the second one. Let me talk here a little bit about the current trend and the approaches to address the challenges that I've previously mentioned. So in terms of the data validity critiques that you can get, the papers, and my suggestions will be a little bit more practical than what Percy was talking about. By the way, Percy, thank you, very fascinating things. So in terms of the data validity, what can you do? Because this is still a common concern in the reviewers' critiques these days. You can look at the prior studies that used similar data. You can compare with the US samples or samples in other countries. You can provide anecdotal evidence and interviews from your setting and settings outside of yours, and you can do tons of robustness checks. In terms of generalizability is still a very common concern these days. I still hear it a lot, probably as much as I heard 10 years ago, 15 years ago. You can discuss how your results might vary in other settings. So for example, kind of one common thing that I typically say in my discussion section, of course, if it's true, and I believe it's true, that even though the size of the coefficients, the magnitude of findings can vary in other institutional settings, I believe that conceptually the findings will still be true outside of the focal country. To give you one example, though, I did come across studies as a reviewer, as an associate editor, where it was an interesting setting, an interesting, let's say, policy change or a natural experiment that the authors took advantage of, But indeed, it wasn't clear how this would generalize to other settings, or is it just an interesting policy change relevant to that country? So a recent one, which I reviewed for one of the top management journals, all three reviewers basically came, and the authors were using an interesting policy change in Canada, a very interesting policy change, fascinating results, but all three reviewers came up with something like along the lines of, okay, a very cool study, very relevant to Canada, but the authors should think about what theoretical implications this would have that we can use outside of their focal setting, outside of Canada, for example. So that's for generalizability. In terms of the third concern, which is still valid, language and the different measurement standards, maybe language a little less of an extent now that we have very good translation services, automatic translation services, but still being familiar with the settings that you study helps a lot and gives your results more credibility. So it really helps to get an author who is native to that setting, a co-author. It also helps to understand the measures well and do not make assumptions that measures are valid and measures replicate those of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I want to address, this is relevant to generalizability, and this also came up in the chat. Why, what we, when we say generalizable, we often mean how this applies to the US setting. Because the top journals that we study, try to publish in, they originated in the United States. I mean, if I take, for example, a Danish study and go try publishing a Danish journal, I don't think anyone would question the validity and generalizability of my findings. Same probably, and Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, if I do a Chinese study and try to publish it in a Chinese academic journal, I don't think anyone would question generalizability of the findings. But because we still try to publish in the top management journals that originated in the United States and have lots of authors publishing from the United States, in many cases, when we say generalizability, we do mean how this applies to the United States. And I mean, it could be right or wrong, but this is the state of the art and we have to play by the rules of the game, and we need to somehow explain how this would apply outside of our settings and how this would apply to the United States. Thank you, Cecilia.
Thank you, Elena. I also appreciate the practical approaches and suggestions that you provide, which give us a very comprehensive overview, putting all three perspectives together to the question about the present. One thing that I learned from your generalizability point is we don't just talk about the limitations of using our non-US data, but be proactive in terms of discussing how the results may actually vary in other settings and address them forefront rather than leaving it to the readers to seeking out the limitations. So before we move on to the last questions, I would like to remind our participants to keep posting your questions and comments in the chat box. I have already seen some great questions that our panelists will be able to answer towards the end of this seminar. So let's just move on to our last talking point. So the last question is about the future. What are the trends and the future directions for publishing with non-US data? Also, I see there are some doctoral students and junior scholars here today with us. So do you have any suggestions for them who are you know, just getting started and maybe considering collecting data or analyzing data which are non-US contexts? So let me start with Percy. I'm sharing your slides. I'm putting out your slides now.
Yeah, thanks, Cecilia. And just to comment on Elena's point, sorry for being not practical at all, but hey, that's me. I just want to start with the confession that I'm also still doing lots of qualitative research where generalizability rarely is a criterion at all. And so the fact that we need to move beyond generalizability when we are judging our theoretical work is something that I've come to accept a long time ago. But what's the final thing that I'm going to leave everyone with, and then perhaps also speak to some of the doctoral students in the room? if you look at the right-hand panel, and Kevin is up there as well, but one of the things that you do see is that I think that I just wanted to make sure that everyone realizes that endemic theorizing is not a flight of fancy, but that is actually all around us, right? And that is actually on the increase or on the ascent. So I've just had a look as to what is published in AMJ over the last year. And there are lots of fascinating studies from China, from Egypt, from France, from Tanzania, from Italy, that essentially talk about topics that are primarily important in those contexts and that are hard to understand outside of the institutional and historical bounds of the setting in which they were produced. And I hope I'm not offending any of the authors involved. But what they primarily help us do, of course, is to understand these important contexts and phenomena better. And I think that we should not judge these studies by their generalizability appeal per se. So let's move over to the left-hand panel, and let me give you my famous last words of the day. I think that an important realization for people who want to work more with non-US data and who would like to claim a greater spot for studies based on this data in our top journals is that we do have to realize that endemic theorizing, like any form of theorizing, actually follows its gatekeepers. Right. The important parallel is that 20 years ago, qualitative research was almost nowhere in our top journals. And a couple of far-sighted journals, probably AMJ, one of the first, started appointing dedicated qualitative editors and reviewers who then, as gatekeepers, opened the door for more qualitative work in those spots. I think that at the same time, while we do not realize it, the same thing is currently happening with more endemic work. And as international or as editorial boards internationalize, we also get more appreciation for the fact that work that comes from other settings also is important, even though it has little saying power over the towards the 5% of the world population that indeed lives in the US. The second thing that I would like to say as one of those people who's been in gatekeeping functions and speaking to others who are also on editorial boards, for example, is that we need to, if we like endemic work, we need to stop undercutting it, right? And I think that generalizability is often a less than useful criterion. And so it makes no sense to use Elena's example to slap people working with Danish data around by the fact that that this does not necessarily generalize a lot, right? I mean, so I think that we need to be more sympathetic towards endemic world and work and judge it on its own merit. Now, what it means, of course, third bullet point, is that we do need new quality criteria for us to actually help us judge such work. I'm not saying that if you need to look less at generalizability, that you don't need to look at important other types of work and other quality criteria. We do, and I can tell you what those criteria and indicators for the assessment of endemic work should be. But one of them, of course, should be the degree of fit, so the explanatory power that they have in context. And final thing that I would say, certainly for many of the younger strategic management researchers in the audience, again, I'm an org theorist, so what do I know? But it seems to me that this stretches, and this newfound love for endemic theorizing stretches far beyond what organization theorists do. It seems to be a matter of fact that we know incredibly little about what competition and competitive advantage look like in non-US contexts. And so I do think that the future for working with non-US data and using it to build endemic theories for other contexts, that has a particularly bright future. And so I'm excited to see more endemic work come out in the near future. I'll stop there again, Cecilia.
Thank you, Percy, for leaving us a positive high note. We will get back to you in a second. But in the meanwhile, let's pass on to Elena. Let me pull out your slides.
Thank you, Cecilia. And Percy, I'm sorry if my comment came across as a critique. I didn't mean it by any way. I actually thought it was great that you take it from the theoretical angle, because as in any papers that we publish, we have the front end, which is the theory, which is kind of where we lay out what we believe into, and then we have this empirical, more sort of down-to-earth data-driven part where we try to confirm. So it was a little bit more of an apology on my side that I'm not raising such kind of high-level conceptual questions as you do, but try to provide some more practical empirical suggestions. which is actually great because all three of us are tackling the question from different angles, which is very beneficial, I believe, to the scholars who came to the seminar. So in terms of the trans future directions, and again, some advice to junior scholars in this area. Trans, I do indeed see more studies on foreign data popping up in management journals than, let's say, 20 years ago, and I think that's great. In terms of the advice, when you use the data outside of the United States, try to be driven not by the fact that, oh, I get access to the data, which is with the same variables as everyone else used in the US data set, for example. But try to use data with some unique features, because these unique features will provide you advantage over those who studied maybe similar settings in the United States or other more popular countries. And these unique features might get you published. So to give you my own example, when I was a PhD student, I got interested in the question of foreign entrepreneurs. And first, to study foreign entrepreneurs, you need a country where you'll have a large enough population of foreign entrepreneurs. So Denmark, for example, wouldn't be a good setting for that, because even though the data are great, but just the sheer number of foreign entrepreneurs, there is not that large for the purpose of the question that I wanted to study. So I looked around, and no one at that time viewed Russia, for example, as a place for immigrants, as a place with many immigrants. But in reality, Russia, for the past 20 years, Russia has typically ranked in the top five countries by the number of immigrants around the world. But unlike the United States, for example, which would be another ideal setting for studying foreign entrepreneurs, the United States doesn't regularly collect data on entrepreneurial small businesses. So finding data on startups in the United States is very difficult, systematic data. Even now, we are still based on surveys in what we study in the United States. But in Russia, Russian government collected data on each and every firm in the country, including small startups. So that was a unique feature of the Russian data. Not because I was Russian, for example, not because I had access to that Russian data, not because that Russian data just came up, but because it provided me with the kind of variables, with the kind of observations that I needed for to address my research question. The second point would be that, of course, countries that are of public interest are easier to sell. So China, for example, there is a lot of interest to China these days, and I believe that really helps in selling the Chinese, setting Chinese studies to the general audience. If you take a small country like Iceland in Europe, that might be a little harder to sell because people feel they understand it well, and it's not as large to attract just general curiosity kind of attention. And as it came up before, just be open about generalizability. Don't leave it to the reviewers to criticize. Just say, okay, I'm aware of the fact that these data are not as common, or setting is not as common as the United States. And I believe that there could be these institutional differences between my setting and the United States, for example, again. And this is how this could affect the findings. So again, taking the European studies, this Danish data, even the Portuguese data, the Spanish data, social security systems there is very different from the one in the United States. And in my entrepreneurship studies, it did come up that, okay, but how would those fewer social security concerns on the side of Danish entrepreneurs affect, for example, their decision to quit outside jobs and run there from themselves? And I do address this in the discussion section. So be open, do whatever you can, show that you are, be proactive, show that you understand that this could be a concern, but here's how it can affect the findings. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alina. And I also very much like the last, the points you make, especially be open about the generalizability. One question pop up from the chat box is asking, being open not only from the author side, but also from the reviewer and editor side. Now, being the editor for all three of you, I'm sure you have something to say, taking a different hat other than author, but the reviewer or the editor yourself. So we'll get back to this question later on after Kevin. Kevin, back to you.
Yeah.
So
actually, it's very interesting that nowadays we have so many submission with Chinese data. Now getting published with China data is getting more difficult. So now, I very much agree with Persis talking about the epidemic research. So basically, it's my approach to the microanalyze unique features. So that approach by identifying the unique puzzle in non-US context can add more insights to existing theories and to make our academic world more colorful. But the challenge of that approach is experience, especially for junior scholars. It's not easy to identify a unique puzzle that we can address it. So my suggestion for junior scholars is use approach three, which I called contextualized unique features. So basically the idea is the main effect is the universal question, universal concept. For example, in this paper, we talk about how political ties affect operational efficiency. So this paper, the main effect is all universal. Okay, we can see it in the US, in China, in Europe, in Latin America, everywhere. But the uniqueness of non-US data is in the moderators. So that's what we call it as a context. So for example, for the moderators in the top, we have factor market development. So this is one institutional factor we consider with China data. So in the US, normally US studies treat institutional factor as a background. And then in the bottom, for emerging market, we talk about foreign shareholding, okay, as a leverage, as a unique resources for local firm to compensate for the lack of resources in the local market. So in this way, actually, we can put the unique feature as a context. So this type of model is relatively easier for junior scholars to master, okay, to learn and to use. So this is the approach I would recommend for junior scholars to take. Of course, the second approach, the microanalyze, identifying the unique puzzle, is very interesting. Okay, personally, I like that approach a lot, which is consistent with Percy's suggestions. But for junior scholars, I would strongly suggest you guys to begin with the contextualized approach because it's very straightforward. The universal concept, universal question with unique features as a context. Okay, so that's my part. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin and Elena Percy, for sharing your thoughts on the past, the present, and the future of publishing non-US data in top strategy and management journals. Now, let's open up the ground for discussions. I will pass on to Fabrice to lead the discussions. Fabrice.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, thank you very much to our panelists for the very insightful discussion. So we received a lot of questions in the chat box. So I will do my best to summarize the main questions. Meanwhile, I will start addressing the questions. Please feel free, you know, to add some questions or some comments you may have in the chat box. So we received like a first set of questions regarding the framing of papers when you use non-US data. So I would like, you know, to ask the different panelists, what has been your strategy, you know, to frame your paper when using non-US data? Are you framing directly in the front end, you know, I have a specific context and, you know, it's part of the whole paper, the title of the paper, the first part of the paper, or you're just keeping that for the empirical section, like the distinction front end, back end. I know, Kevin, that, for instance, you introduce different strategies, you know, to work with non-US data. So I assume that it means like different ways to frame your paper. So can you the three of us, can you extend on that, please?
Yeah. So I think to answer this question, I think it depends. It really depends on the research question. So if we can find a unique puzzle as approach two, then I will highlight, for example, China in the title, in the abstract, in the opening positioning. But if we take approach three, the contextualized approach, then the question itself is universal. It applies everywhere. Then I would put China in the background. Okay. So in this way, China is just a context to test the research questions. So that's my approach. Depends.
Proceed, Elena. Do you have another take on the question?
Yeah, Fabrice, maybe I can jump in. As a junior scholar, when I was trying to publish my Russian studies, the advice that I received from my advisors and other senior scholars was try to tone down your country claim and start with something more conceptual. So that's what I was doing in my kind of foreign entrepreneurs in Russia papers. I was starting with a conceptual question, kind of being driven by the gap in the literature. But then in the introduction, I say something like, okay, but to address this question, I use this unique setting of foreign entrepreneurs in Russia. And then I briefly say what the uniqueness of that setting is and how this setting is great for studying the exact questions that I'm trying to ask.
Makes sense.
So let me, next to what Kevin and Elena said, let me give two complementary perspectives quickly. I think we all are professional writers, right? And so the question is what will stir up the interest in our audience, right? I mean, what does that make them say, hey, I want to read more about this? Because that's essentially what you're after if you're chasing that mighty R&R. I think one of the things that we have seen in the field is that, and that's an adjacent development, but one of the things that we have seen is that there is increasingly an appetite for more phenomenon-driven work, right? So an increasing number of papers just start by launching a real-world problem, whether it is related to equity, to sustainability, to inclusion, all that kind of stuff, where you say, hey, we really are talking about a really important real-world phenomenon here, and so that's one way of getting the attention that does not necessarily require you to talk about context all that much. That's one additional strategy that you may think of, although it should be used with caution. Another one that you see more of, but this is especially important in qualitative research, is that we kind of have seen a race towards ever extreme contexts, right? I mean, every one of us also is, we all have voyeuristic tendencies. And so we all get interested when the context becomes really extreme and the research design becomes dangerous, when field workers expose themselves to real harm, so to speak. So in addition to more phenomenon-led theorizing, what you also see increasingly amongst qualitative researchers in order to draw the attention to a unique setting is to go more extreme. And that kind of also downplays the importance of generalizability and in which particular country that setting has been located. So there are only complementary perspectives to what Kevin and Elena said, but these are two other things that I commonly observe also as an editor.
Okay, well, thank you. So as a follow-up, Percy, you were talking about like qualitative data. I think we had some questions in the chat box about it. Can you maybe extend on the question of qualitative versus quantitative non-US data? I assume, like, again, that there are like different approaches, different advantages and different challenges associated with qualitative versus quantitative data as well.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting to see that in principle we are all one community of management scholars, and yet the standards for assessing work are so different, right? In many ways. So what I would say is that there is a real dearth of real good qualitative work from other contexts than Western Europe and the US. And so we are screaming for more, as a qualitative community, we are screaming for more studies from Africa, from Latin America, from China, which are done to the highest quality standards, but which still fully flesh out this endemic perspective. And so that one of the questions that we had is, What do you think that if you were a young scholar and you wanted to do it all over again, where would you start? Well, I think that any gamble on good qualitative work from these far-flung locales is a really good gamble to start your career with at this particular day and age.
Elena, Kevin, do you have any other viewpoints on the question? The distinction qualitative versus quantitative data?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with qualitative data because all of my work are quantitative. So for me, I think for qualitative data, the challenge is how to ensure the theoretical insights is really different from what we know. Because many times, some of the qualitative study, it seems to reveal something obvious to what we already know. So that's, as an editor, sometimes the concern from qualitative data is the novel insights. Okay. How can we integrate the unique features of non-US context and derive the true insights from qualitative data? That's something really pose challenge for young scholars. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Ella, do you have anything to add on that? Or?
Well, as Kevin, I'm more of a quantitative kind of researcher. But what I found quite interesting in the recent publications and journals, people combining quantitative and qualitative data in one study, whereas they provide some evidence on the historical data with quantitative methods, but they also provide some qualitative results using qualitative data. And those combination studies, they're very believable, first of all. And second, because they provide evidence from different angles, they're much easier to trust the findings.
Okay. I think, Elena, at some point in your first slide, you mentioned like also using some quotes from interviews. So in your quantitative paper, have you done that? And do you think it has been helpful?
I've done this a lot, both on my own initiative and because reviewers ask me for that. And that's, again, how you can address generalizability through that. You provide big empirical results on a big data set outside of the United States, but then you can find or do interviews in the United States. I did them in the United States and Canada. I also pulled out interviews, and interview quotes done by other researchers, done in other settings outside of my focal setting. Like for the Russian study done in the US and Canada, that at least in the anecdotal way, it provide evidence which is consistent with what I find in my big Russian data set.
Okay, it's a great suggestion, yeah, indeed. Okay, thank you. So we also had some questions regarding the impact for practitioners. Do you think that there is something specific about non-US data when we talk about like the practical implications, the managerial aspect of a paper? Do you think it talks mostly like to the managers in the country in question, or it also can have like an impact, a specific impact on practitioners and managers like in other context?
Actually, my experience is when we use non-US data, this adds a lot of managerial insights for multinational firms because most of the traditional knowledge is built on the US, it's a unique country in nearly all the aspects. It's a so unique country with only 5% of the population. And so when multinational companies enter different countries, they really need the insights from no non-US data, non-US context, and non-US findings to provide them with something different from traditional Western theory would predict. So in this sense, I think non-US data-based research can generate a lot of impact regarding how practitioners should do in China, in Brazil, in India, okay, rather than relying on arm length transaction in American sense. Okay.
My experience was very similar to Kevin in terms of when you talk to executives of multinational corporations, or they're fascinated to find studies about new interesting settings. Again, like 15 years ago, multinationals wanted to go to Russia, and finding a study that tells them about policy changes in Russia or how firms operate in Russia, they found it very interesting. But even in, I have had a lot of experience talking to executives when I was a professor at Duke. And even when you talk, when I talked about my findings for entrepreneurs and not necessarily international firms, but domestic firms, they seem to be less concerned about generalizability outside of non-US setting, but they tended to in general believe that what's true in other countries for entrepreneurs would also be to, at least to some extent, true in the United States and like in other major nations. They seem to be less concerned than my academic audience.
I see.
Yeah, and of course, the reason I'm not going to break my my perfect track record of not answering the questions that you posed to me, I'm not going to do that right now. So one thing that I would say here is that in general, I'm not a big believer in of the model whereby science communication alone will lead to impact, right? I think that what Elena says, that the chances for impact are first of all greater if you, for example, take it into the classroom. I guess that's one way of doing it. I also think that if you really want to have impact, there's no substitute for real engaged scholarship, where you also do research that is just much closer up on the skin of your actual stakeholders, right? The only thing that I would say there, though, is also a note of caution, in the sense that we oftentimes give very wrong prescriptions to young scholars if you want to do that, right? I think that we oftentimes tend to give them the advice that, yeah, this is nice, but this is something that you can only pick up after tenure. That's kind of like the same advice as telling someone to be a concert pianist when they're in their 40s, right? I think that the real skill that you have to have real impact on practice is something that, if you want to, you need to build your skill as an engaged scholar from very early on. And that's a muscle that you really, really need to train from the earliest get-go. But that may be a better topic for another in one of these great series, Fabrice, and then we necessarily go into very much in depth today.
Okay, no, thank you. So we also had a question about kind of the level of aggregation. Like, when we talk about non-US data, should we focus on the regional level, the national level, maybe some international level, like maybe at the European level? So I think, Elena, yeah, you put some good insights in the chat box, like to start answering this question. But, you know, of course, it depends on the research question, but how does it depend on the research question? Can you, the three of us, can you extend on that, please?
Maybe I can start, since I tried to address this question in the chat already. In my eyes, this really depends on the research questions that you try to ask. If you do an international strategy study, so for example, we look at subsidiaries of South Korean multinationals, we really take advantage of them locating all over the world in different countries, because institutional differences provide us our key empirical variables. The variation in these institutional factors gives us an opportunity to study interesting questions about these subsidiaries. When I looked at entrepreneurs, for example, that's where I found that focusing on one country was much easier, because there I didn't care as much about the institutional differences. They were my control variables, and they could provide more noise than benefit. And that's where going in depth in one country was more beneficial than looking across, let's say, several countries in Europe, because you have to control for many differences across those countries, and they're not your differences of interest.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd be curious to see what others think, what Percy and Kevin think about this.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. So if we want to do IB study, then definitely we need to collect multinational data. But if I'm only interested in, for example, the China question, and China alone would be sufficient, okay, to address this research question. And Usually we do not only conduct a study within a small region or small city, then representativeness would raise a concern. For example, for my Chinese studies, I try to collect data, especially the secondary data, all over China. So it's a national level data. So in this sense, it seems I rarely see some studies use regional data. Regional means city or province level. So that's my perception. Okay.
Yeah, maybe a final perspective is, and this harks back to quite a number of meta-analyses that I've did, and then especially comparative ones where you look across national boundaries. I think that for most of the main effects that we tend to theorize, roughly 25 to 35% of the variance in any of those relationships is determined by country-level factor. And so if you just want to study, and I'm being provocative here, but if you just want to study one national context for any of those relationships and you don't care about not explaining 35% of your variance, be my guest. But if you want to come to models that have closer fit about companies that operate globally, you do, whether you like it or not, but you will have to take on board those institutional factors that actually condition the behavior in any national given context, or you're just going to miss out on, or you're just going to leave at least a quarter of your variance unaddressed, floating by in the error term. That's what it is. So I am a big believer in comparative work. And a big believer in if you can model the relevant institutional conditions that condition the behavior and outcomes of firms on the ground. And that's true pretty much everywhere.
Okay. Another very important question. And I think when I look like all the participants today, I think there is a strong selection bias today, because if you're here today, it's likely that maybe you're already convinced that working with non-US data is important. But key question is about, okay, how to change the mindset of the gatekeepers. I think Percy used the word gatekeepers. So like the reviewers, the editors, the journals. I think like the three of us have been reviewers for sure, also editors. So is it a discussion you have in your respective journals? And how can we change that, you know, as a community, at the collective level? How can we change the mindset of the journals and the reviewers and the editors?
If I can take this one first for change, Fabrice, one thing that I would say is that if you invert the question and you think, so what are the prospects for Fortress America, right? So completely U.S. journals run by a completely U.S. editorial team that would be keen to keep out any outside views that kind of disturb this need world, I would say the prospects there are pretty dim, right? We see that the increase of non-US editors on journals, editorial boards, and of non-US reviewers on reviewer boards is staunchly increasing over the last 20 years. And what is interesting is that communities themselves are also calling upon editorial boards to become more diverse, right? And that also, for example, means gender diversity next to international diversity. But there are strong endemic pressures on boards to become more diverse. And as they become more diverse, then I think that inevitably the composition also of what journals write about or what journals publish will also change over time. So I really am quite hopeful that while there are still a couple of journals out there, even top journals, that kind of celebrate their Fortress US status. But I'd be super worried if that was your business model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually see in the past 20 years, the change already happened. So I still remember 20 years ago when I submitted a paper based on China data to talk about innovation. The reviewer's comment is, it's China. eligible for, is China suitable for studying innovation research? Then we have to explain a lot how China did innovation back to 2000, okay, at that time. But today, yes, I think not many reviewers raise similar questions about China data or non-US data. Now, more critically is about the significance of the contribution. and whether the data match with the research question. So today, for us, probably we should care more about the match between the theoretical model and the data validity, and also the theoretical significance of our research model. I think that's what the editors and the reviewers care the most today. Okay.
Mm-hmm. My impression is similar to Kevin's and Bruce's, that the situation is getting better. And keep in mind that VAEs and reviewers, we've been beaten ourselves on these questions before. So we are very sympathetic to other authors who are facing same sort of generalizability critiques from reviewers. Though we have seen fewer of them these days. I mean, there are, but they're fewer. And in my experience, we can ask an author to address generalizability concerns, but I don't think I ever rejected the paper solely based on generalizability concerns. I mean, this is something you should address, but really this is the complete, like, only breaking point over which the paper cannot be published.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think we have covered the main points in the chat box. Maybe I'm missing some important questions. If you think I missed an important question, I think it's the time, you know, to raise your hand and maybe ask our panelists additional questions. Any burning question you may have for panelists? Or Cecilia, do you think I missed something important in the chat?
No, I think you cover it very well. So just to follow up with the first question about the framing, I think across the borders, including myself, right? Sometimes you're just considering the debating how to place the context. Now that we all know our context matters, but where to place it? Do we start off with the framing to incorporate the context in your theorization, or do you place the context towards the end when you introduce the data and methodology? Now, I'm sure there's pros and cons in two approaches, and when to do that with it's a craftsmanship. So I would like to pick your mind on this if you haven't got to this point for the first question about the framing.
Yeah, so we all need to think very long and hard about your question there, Cecilia. That's obvious, right? I mean, no one dares to take it. One of the things that I sometimes say to my when I teach a class to doctoral students is that look, it is hard to learn in our profession because so many papers get rejected that it's oftentimes very difficult to find out what the real driving cause is. But 100 submissions and quite a few scars later in my career, one thing that I've become convinced of is that the middle of the road is a much more dangerous place to ride than the shoulder. Right. And so if you want to write a paper that rides on context, right, and if you want to write a paper in which context is one of the unique selling points, then you also need to make sure that it's not a middle of the road context, but you need to find the context that is spicy, that is enticing, and that people definitely want to read about. Right. And whether it's Dean Shepherd writing about Indian rag pickers, or whether it's Will Mitchell, the late Will Mitchell, writing about micro entrepreneurs in Kathmandu, but you need to find a context and you need to find a phenomenon that is immediately evocative if you want to sell your study on context, right? I mean, the more middle of the road you go, and if you're looking at an innovation system that looks like, and that is not in the US, but it looks like an innovation system, like it could be anywhere in the US, for example, I wouldn't sell it on context, right? You should only prioritize your context as kind of like a rhetorical writing trick or as a rhetorical a writing device, if it is indeed sufficiently spicy to immediately attract the attention of your readership.
Yeah, I fully agree. We can only sell the context on the condition it is spicy, it reveals a puzzle, and it reveals something really interesting in the specific context. To give you an example, my colleague Danqing Wang, she published a paper on how the mayor's retirement age affect local companies' merger and acquisition activity. So these two variables, in normal sense, nobody would link this together. But in China, the mayor's retirement did affect local companies' behavior. So this is a puzzle. So this is very unique and very interesting. So we can see on the context. So in this case, so the authors put the China into the title, put the context into everywhere. So however, if we cannot identify such a unique puzzle, or if our research question is kind of universal, for example, today, how AI affect firm performance, then probably there's no way to emphasize Chinese AI is different from US AI. They are all AI, right? So in this case, then we just put the context as a background. Okay. So to don't emphasize context until the methodology part.
I agree. It depends on what is interesting, what is more interesting in your study. Is this the gap in the literature that you're trying to address, or maybe that's something about your data? To give you an example, Michael Dahl had a paper at ASQ where he looked at how entrepreneurship affects mental well-being of individuals. And he had access to this cool part of the Danish data where he could see all medications that people took. So, I mean, his variable was basically whether people when transitioning into entrepreneurship started taking some medications that would help them to retain good mental state. And that was a great selling point of his paper because no one had access to anything similar at that time. So just think about what would attract attention and what would reviewers and readers find very interesting about your setting and about your questions.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay, so before concluding the session, I think I would like to turn to Michael Leblen. I think, Michael, you would like to say a few words. Michael is the past division chair of the STR division.
Well, I don't need to say many words. I other than thank you. Louise had to jump off. So she asked me to sort of step in. So the division, as you all know, has been doing a lot of these kinds of virtual sessions for some time. I enjoyed listening to you folks. The AI, this is the innovation I saw was the AI Otter Chat, although I lost access. So I lost access to all the wonderful notes that AI had been taking for me on your comments. I do think, Cecilia, I'll offer one comment from the STR division. And maybe one comment from, so my advisor was this guy, Dan Schindel, founder of the SMS. And so I think relates a lot to Cecilia's question. And so to me, what's important is sort of the future of the field and whether there is some sort of distinctive competence in something called strategic management. And I think that your answer to that is going to take you a long way towards whether you want to be context specific, interesting, spicy was the word I think I heard, Percy, data that's going to help you get published, which is obviously important for everybody's career. But I think the challenge really is, the future of the field as a distinct entity and sort of how do you balance those two things becomes super interesting. So, I mean, I loved, there were several things here so I could compliment everybody, but Elena, I took away early slide. I wish I had the AI on the chat. I've experienced some of the challenges you were talking about in terms of managing data across multiple countries and sort of thinking about how we do that is one thing I'd encourage for everybody. And as I commented early, Percy and I may have different views on the importance of endemic studies, but what's I think undisputable across both of us is the importance of generating some coherence across these mixed findings or non-findings in a US-centric 1980s data set versus something someplace else, in 2020 or 2025 for that matter. And so those are just exciting questions to me that I think address this. One of the places I've been thinking, which I didn't hear, is Simon's Science of the Artificial talked a good deal about the importance of context-specific relevant data that would address some of the practical concerns that, that the group was talking about later in the conversation. So I think some of the groundwork for what you might be thinking about, how do I maintain practical importance in these unique contexts, is sort of outlined by somebody who's, you know, obviously was incredibly capable. But thank you. If somebody can tell me how to use the Otter a tool, that man, that would be fantastic. But that's for another day. And thank you all for starting my day off in the East Coast of the U.S. On a positive note. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to all the panelists. I mean, I think Michael raised a very interesting question about the kind of research we want to do as a community. You know, 95% of the worldwide population is not located in the U.S. So as a social scientist, you know, what kind of research do we want to do, and who is the audience? I think it would be one of the takeaways of today's discussion. I think before we leave, Cecilia, we need to take a picture of you. Yeah. So if you can turn on your camera, make a nice smile to everyone. Cecilia, I'll let you take the picture.
Okay. I'm waiting for everyone to turn on your camera if you are here with us, do you? Okay. So everybody look at your camera on the count of 3, 2, 1, cheese. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me check whether I got it. Okay, just take one more in case this doesn't work. Hold on for 1 second. Okay, everyone again, look at the camera one more time. 1, 2, 3, cheese. All right, thank you everyone. A big applause to our panelists today for sharing their experiences and insight about the past, the present, and the future of publishing top-tier journal papers with non-US data. Thank you all for your great questions and participating in our seminar today. And please keep an eye on the AOMSTR announcements, as we have many more seminars addressing relevant and important topics in the months to come. Thank you again, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, thank you, Selina.
Have a great day.
Bye.